Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Fly Girl Show. I am Casey Grant, your host, and I am so happy that you tuned in today. We have a wonderful, wonderful show and a very interesting person who happens to be a personal friend of mine. His name is Judge Raymond Jones, and he's here today to talk about, as we are all celebrating, 50 years of the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. Judge Jones was in that march, and he's going to share his story of the different things that happened behind the scene and his personal experience of that famous march in 1965. Good morning, Judge Jones. How are you today?
Good morning, Casey. I'm fine, and I'm happy to be alive.
Isn't that the truth? Happy to be alive and happy to be a part of such a monumental event in 1965, the march from Selma to Montgomery, fighting for our civil rights, fighting for just the right to vote. It just seems so far-fetched that we didn't have that right. And it, what also was very disturbing to me is the fact that people don't exercise that right.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. A very disturbing thing.
Yes. Very disturbing. So tell my audience a little bit about you. You live in Denver. You are you a retired judge, or are you still active in law? Or tell us a little bit about you.
Yes, I am a senior judge, which is to say that I am retired from the active day-to-day bench work. But as a senior judge, I'm available to the Supreme Court to be appointed to hear cases where judges may be sick or on vacation. So I continue to do that work. Additionally, however, I practice law. I'm in a law firm and stay very busy with the practice of law in addition.
Well, and you're still actively involved in telling the world and telling different audiences in Denver about your experience. But I want to get to that. But let's find out. Tell us how you became involved in the 60s in the movement.
Well, my mom and dad used to say that I never had a childhood, that I was always talking about and worried about things that kids aren't supposed to be worried about. And one of those things was the civil rights movement. I grew up in Pueblo, Colorado, which, frankly speaking, wasn't such a bad place for black people to be. It's a working class town. There's a steel mill there. Most of the kids I know, along with my own father, worked in the steel mill. Most of our mothers worked also at various and sundry things. And so there was a real leveling effect in Pueblo, Colorado, as I was growing up. But my dad took the Pittsburgh Courier, a wonderful old black newspaper, and we read Jet and Ebony. And so we kept up on the state of affairs of black people around the country. And at a very young age, I began to be very, very disturbed about issues of discrimination concerning our people, And my mother was constantly saying, don't worry about it, you worry too much. But those things were always on my mind. I was always trying to discuss matters of discrimination and inappropriate and unfair application of law, the fact that black kids could not go to really good schools in the South, and that people couldn't vote. My father was very, very active in Democratic politics, and so I was aware of issues having to do with politics and the danger in the unequal share that black people had to have in the South concerning, and more than in the South, concerning matters of politics and matters that touched on politics, such as the schools, having access to theaters, having access to parks and swimming pools and things like that. I didn't experience them at the time growing up in Pueblo, Colorado, but I was very, very aware of them. And my mother was constantly saying, don't worry about it. You're not subject to that, so don't worry about it. But I would tell her, but we have to worry about those who are subject to that kind of unequal share in the living of life. So I was always a serious kid. They exactly. disregarded me as being way too serious for my age. But you know, I would often, when the mill that my dad worked at went on strike, I would walk the picket lines with him. I saw some terrible, terrible things walking those picket lines as a kid, because in Pueblo, Colorado, at the steel mill, which was the major life source for most of the families, when scabs would come to take the place of picketers, it went very, very badly for them. There were fights. There were some very, very serious business going on, and I saw all of that, and it helped to shape me into a person who became dedicated to equality, matters touching on employment and the right to employment and so forth. And you know, I was just a very serious kid. I did really well in school. In fact, I enjoy showing my old report cards to my kids. They're nothing but A's on my old report card.
Oh.
They still
I'll never show mine.
Believe
I'll
it.
Never show mine. I'll never show mine, I tell you. But you know what? Because that just shows you how we are destined to be who we are and to do the things, and how you are shaped and were shaped at an early age. So the seriousness that you displayed manifests into being a judge, fighting for equal rights, and also serving to disperse equal and fair, I suppose, like sentences, I guess I would say, or litigations or whatever you've done. So I tell you, it formed the person that you are. And did your mother lived long enough to know that you were judge, right?
Yes,
she had been appointed
did.
A judgeship. Okay, okay.
Yes, unfortunately, okay. My father did not, but I have to think that that he was looking down on heaven and helping shape my route as I went through life. Yes.
Well, he was instrumental, though, and for him to take you with him in such a serious matter as, you know, strikes and the picketing, that was a very good thing for a father. He was instilling value in you then, and to see the
yes.
different things that were happening. Yeah, so he played his part. He may not have been there for the end of the line, but he was definitely there in the beginning, in the formative years. So you
yes.
went on to school. You took this on. And so did you always want to be an attorney, or did you find out that this was the best way to fight all the different injustices?
Well, originally, as I was growing up, I I thought I would like to be a diplomat because I became from reading Jet and Ebony and the Pittsburgh Courier, I became aware of the problems that were arising in Africa concerning the countries that were getting out from under their European masters and taking over and African people taking over their own governments. And so I thought that, you know, becoming a diplomat, working with the UN, that would be really, really good work in terms of helping to shape African nations. When I got to college, I went to Colorado College in Colorado Springs, Colorado. It's a small, private, very, very good liberal arts college. And I began to get a sense of the fact that maybe law was going to be better for me and would give me the opportunity to work on issues, particularly issues as to our people here in the United States, that maybe my real quest was to help liberate our people here in the United States. And so at that time I became very interested in law, read everything there was about the law. Thurgood Marshall was one of my heroes.
Of course.
Still is. Yes.
And all of those. Absolutely, our hero. Yes.
Yes, that great group of lawyers that he put together that framed the approach in Brown versus Board of Education and so many of the other cases that changed the whole landscape here in America concerning black people.
Exactly. Yes, as they said, the separate was not equal, and so on. Yeah.
Yes.
So give us your introduction into the march, which, for those who would like to just be refreshed about it, we were fighting for the right to vote.
That's right. In Alabama at that time, in other states as well, but the Selma March has to do with Alabama, black people were not allowed to register. The technicality was, you can't vote because you're not registered. Well, the problem was, the registrars in the various counties and cities and towns would not allow people to register to vote, and therefore, yes, they could not vote. And I really followed it as closely as I could, and it was absolutely numbing to think that people were being prohibited from registering to vote, that bothered me. That was one of the things that my mother used to tell me: don't worry about it. That's not anything that we face here. And it wasn't that my mother wasn't concerned. I think she just felt that, you know, be a little boy for a while. You're going to grow up and be a man and face these things. Just be a little boy. But the things really bothered me greatly. And when James Farmer and some of the others down in Alabama really began to put on a strong campaign to change the practice of disallowing blacks to register, that really caught my attention because as a kid, I used to go walk around and remind people to vote, remind my mom and dad and so forth. So that really, really touched me, that people were absolutely being refused the ability to register. And so I followed it very closely, as much as I could, through the newspapers and through the radio. We didn't have a television then. But I stayed aware of the fact that every time black people tried to register, they were either beaten or dogs were set on them. or they were arrested, and even children being put into jail. It bothered me greatly, and so I was very, very happy when the group of people who actually started the move toward a march to Montgomery, the capital of Alabama, to petition the governor to make the registrars in the various counties register, allow black people to register. And I was following that very, very carefully, and it was a long campaign that was going on in Alabama. Many people don't remember that was a very, very long campaign. It started even before President Kennedy was assassinated in 1964, and when Johnson became the president, people really worried because Johnson was from Texas. He hadn't really sounded much on issues of civil rights, but he was from Texas, and that worried people greatly.
Exactly.
And it worried me, frankly, because I had the impression that Kennedy, although Kennedy was not moving quickly on issues of black people voting and other matters of civil rights, the thinking was that had he lived, he would have certainly pushed more than Johnson did. But as it turned out, Johnson really showed a side of him that I think a lot of Texans themselves had never seen, and certainly the country had not seen. I think he became very, very bothered by the fact that black people were being kept from registering to vote. And one of the strategies became for Martin Luther King to go to Washington. He spent a lot of time in Washington talking to Johnson and trying to get some action on the federal front. And at that time, as you'll remember, Bobby Kennedy was the Attorney General, and Bobby was trying to get some things done down in the South. But Bobby Kennedy, I think the literature now shows, was being regarded as kind of a punk kid by the Southern governors, by the Southern sheriffs, and by others who were getting some connection from Bobby Kennedy through his sending down lawyers to scope out the situation concerning the failure of blacks to be able to register and vote. It's the history shows that not a lot was being able to be done. People were still being beaten and arrested and so forth for trying to register to vote. So Farmer and King and others who were local Alabama people, and that march, incidentally, I mean, King was very important to it, but the truth is Alabama people were really at the heart of that. They suffered the consequences of trying to organize the march and trying to get the march going. Many of us know that the march happened in three phases. The first phase was the first time that they walked up the face of the Pettus Bridge, not knowing that on the other side of the bridge there were sheriffs and state patrolmen, police, and just about anyone who could handle a billy club, waiting for the marchers to come over the top of the bridge and start down. And as they went down the other side of the Pettus Bridge, headed out to Montgomery, they were met with the most incredible criminality. from those police forces and driven
back. Now, let
me
ask you, were you there from the very beginning? When did you become involved in the march?
I actually took a strong interest even before the turn of the year. Still back in 1964, I was taking an interest and reading everything I could about what's the situation, is it changing at all concerning black people being able to register and vote. And so I was keeping in touch with that situation through the media. And, of course, after that first attempt, the group was beaten back. In the meantime, Kennedy had been working with Johnson to frame up a situation whereby the march would go forward from Selma to Montgomery, and that the marchers would be protected by the Alabama National Guard, which would be which the president can, and often the presidents do, convert a National Guard into United States soldiers. And King was able to get Johnson to do that, so that on the second march, when people came over the bridge, that same phalanx of thug sheriffs and police and others were down there, but because of King's promise to Johnson that they would not force the issue at that time, people turned back and peaceably went back up over the bridge. But the understanding was that there would be a third attempt, and that the third attempt the National Guard would be on hand to protect the marchers. In the meantime, and while the plans for the third and final march were being done, and I was kind of keeping up on this through the media, white citizens and police and other people were beating up people. They beat a woman who was one of the people putting the third march together. They beat her unconscious. They just beat the devil out of her. They also killed a woman.
Also have the Jackson. Jimmy Lee Jackson was killed too.
The young man. Yes, he was. And in fact, we'll never really know just how many casualties there were. They were beating people right and left. And when I, just jumping ahead for a moment, when I went down there, I met a woman named Viola Luizzo. She, to me, is a hero to this day. She was a union worker from Michigan, I believe. And she had assumed a strong role in helping to organize the march. Additionally, I had heard of a white pastor who went down from the north, and he was just outright murdered. They literally caught him on a sidewalk after dinner one evening, kidnapped him and killed him, beat him to death. Reverend James Reeb, and it was actually Reverend Reeb's death that motivated me to say, I'm going down there. If this white pastor can go down there and give his life, then I can go down there and try to help people who have never been able to vote, to register to vote. I can do that. That was what made the difference for me. Now, at that time, it was 1964 into 1965. I had just turned 18 on November 30th of 1964, so I was a brand new 18-year-old kid,
Exactly. Yes.
And, and with a determination that I'm going to help these people get the right to vote. My mother and father worried about it. My mother's from Kentucky. My father is from Western Kansas. They both had a sense of how awful things can happen in those situations.
And the danger. Yeah, the danger
yes.
you were placing yourself in to fight for, which was a just cause. I mean, isn't it the 14th or 15th Amendment that had given us the right, had given people the right to vote and their civil rights, and here we're being denied?
Right, exactly. It's the right to vote is seen as a civil right, and through the 14th Amendment, we're all given the right to vote. What I did, I was in college at that time. The march, as it turns out, was going to be in the week of spring break at my college. So I thought, this is most fortuitous. I'm going to be able to go down there and march and not miss any classes. So I had to worry about how I was going to go. Well, many people won't remember, many of your listeners won't even know of this, but back at that time, we did a lot of hitchhiking, at least here in the West we did.
We hitchhiked all over the world, yes. Hitchhiking
yes.
was the way to go, yes.
Exactly. So I decided, I had a friend who was going home, and he was headed kind of central north, and I decided I would get a ride with him as far as I could, or as close as I could to Kentucky, because I had two aunts in Kentucky, and I figured once he let me out, I would just hitchhike the rest of the way. I told my mother and father, they were just, my mom was scared
Mortis.
To death.
I'm sure she was. I'm sure you're 18 years old and you're hitchhiking through the South, or, oh my goodness.
Yeah, so I hitchhiked to Louisville. One reason too that for wanting to get to Louisville was because I knew that King had a brother there who had a church, and I figured that there would be a group from Dr. King's brother's church going down to the march, and sure enough, when I got there, I found out yes, they were going down to the march, and before they left, they were doing a voter registration drive in Louisville. So I got involved in that voter registration drive, and asked them, could I go down to the march with their group? And they said, no, you can't. You're too young, and we're not going to be responsible for you. And I told them, hey, I'll be responsible for myself. You won't have to worry about it. So I told my two aunts that I was going to be going down to the march, and they literally wanted to to tie me up and lock me in a bedroom.
Right, because
to keep
it was
me
so
from
dangerous.
Going.
Sure,
well,
it was so
yes,
dangerous.
And they were worried sick. They called my mom, and they said, you know, you can't let him go. You cannot let him go down there to Alabama, and. My mom, knowing me, she said, let him go. So
right.
The following morning, they gave me a ride out to the airport. They were very unhappy to be taking me to the airport. Dr. King's brother's group was going to fly down to Selma and then catch up with the march, because the march had begun the day before we actually got there. So we flew down. We got a ride in a huge farm truck. I'd never seen a truck so big as this. And and they told us, if you see cars coming up fast in either direction, you get down on the floor immediately. And I said, oh, my goodness, I'm in the South.
Because, yes,
there were
the way people had to live, yes.
Yeah, and, of course, people riding on the highways were subject to being shot at by people, coming in either direction. So my fear, I was smart enough to be afraid. I was dumb enough to be there and smart enough to be afraid.
Absolutely.
But we caught up with the march, and we joined the march. First thing I noticed was the National Guard troops had trained their rifles not on the bystanders, the white people who were jeering and throwing bricks, throwing rocks, calling us the N-word, speaking terribly of our women. I said, my goodness, this is incredible. But what for me saved it, I've always sung in my church choir, and I love music. I still love to sing to this day. And I'm telling you, the marchers were singing, and I'd sung all of these songs, religious songs, spirituals, but I have never in my life heard them sung so beautifully as they were being sung on that march. People, the whole idea was to take people's minds off the danger by having us singing and harmonizing, talking to each other. And so I quickly joined right in, as I love singing, and I sing bass, and people kind of enjoyed having a bass voice. There were other bass voices, but I enjoyed the singing.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, the people down south have been going through all these different hardships and maybe not fully known to the rest of the world. And when that's one reason why Martin Luther King was brought in, because it needed that extra attention, because all the different things, and here you were thrown into it. You volunteered to get involved because you were following it. But a lot of people, if you didn't see it on TV, you didn't know it existed. You didn't know. And I think when the National Guard was involved, and then the water hoses and the dogs, that's what infuriated the rest of the world when we got that coverage. And also a lot of cameramen that were covering it, their cameras were destroyed so that the word would not get out.
Yes, that did happen. Absolutely it did. And I think that President Johnson, who was from Texas and I think would be regarded as a Southerner, knew he could not face the world as president and let that be going on. And so he took a strong hand without question. I mean, it still was dangerous. I mean, there were people sicking dogs, people on the sidelines sticking dogs out into the march, and wouldn't you know that one of the dogs bit me. I'm standing there limping along with my ankle bleeding and seeing all these people, and the dog bit me.
he must have
smelled some northern meat. But
he must have. But you also have your medal of the awareness that you were there. Your reminder that you were a part of history, the part of giving us the equal rights. I was a child watching a lot of this on TV, and I, like you, was not exposed. My father was military, so I went to a good school. We shopped any place we wanted to. We had our own problems in Rantoul, Illinois, but I didn't know. I was still shielded from that. But I remember watching it on TV, too, and my heart, when you see a dog attacking a human being, and when you see Martin Luther King, or you see people, as you said, you were singing. You were singing for the peace. You were singing for unity among the marchers. And then you see the other vicious people screaming at you and throwing things at you. how could it not affect a person? No matter what age you were, the reality of what was going on, the injustice, and we wanted to vote, which was a political process that we would all do.
Exactly. It was an amazing thing, and I can't believe I just stood there while the dog was actually biting me, you know, on the theory that, you know, nonviolence applies to dog bites, too. So I stood there and let the dog bite me, and I'm going to tell you right now, I was crying. I was crying tears because I knew now this. I'm in this, and
exactly.
This is the least of what could happen to me. But people were so wonderful.
You were no longer that. Yeah, you weren't a child anymore. You grew up. When you stepped into that situation, that 18-year-old boy that went down, that was so involved and concerned about the concern of others, you grew up. You were a man.
Oh, yes, I grew up. I surely did. But what was so wonderful was the love. That it was like there was a hood of love over us. That highway is a typical, I don't know if I would say typical Southern, but a typical rural highway. It was narrow, and so the people who were shouting things at you, throwing things at you, they were close. They were right up on you. But one of the things I want to talk about is how strange, how very strange things were. At one point, from time to time, the march would stop because people would be singing or praying, kneeling down and praying and so forth. At one point when it stopped, so you're standing there in the road, the National Guard standing there pointing their rifles at you. People are yelling and screaming and have Dixie flags. And I just happened to catch the eye of a young white woman who's not much older than me. She might have been 20. And we looked at each other and then looked away. And I looked back at her and she was looking at me and she'd look away. And then I'd be looking at her and I was thinking, maybe there's the milk of human kindness along this route as well. I wasn't trying to make it with the woman. I was just trying to examine, is this an individual who has a sense that this is wrong, that this march is for a good purpose? Well, as soon as the march started up again, she came running out into the march, spat right into my face. Right?
No.
The first thing I'm thinking is that, is it okay to wipe the spit off of you? Honestly.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that right?
That was another growing up moment on the Selma March. I was just glad it wasn't a man. But those kinds of things were happening. And other things, at one point I was marching along, you fell in with people. And I fell in with a gentleman, kind of middle-aged Southern gentleman, and he said, I just love the way you talk. And I said, well, where are you from? I told him Pueblo, Colorado. And he knew of Pueblo, Colorado. He knew there was a steel mill there. I said, yeah, my dad works in the steel mill. So he said, listen, you keep marching, but I want to bring some people back. So he went running ahead, and he came back with about 20 or 25 little kids. There were children on that march, grade school and junior high school kids, and he brought them back and he gathered them around me, and he said, I want you kids to talk to this man. I want you to talk just like him. I want you to learn from him how he got to talk that way, and I want you to start talking that way because he talks proper. And
oh,
so for the next 5 miles, me and those kids, it was like I felt like you know, like a school teacher. We're walking along, the kids are walking along.
Exactly.
Some of their parents were there. One little girl said, Mommy, can we take him home with us?
Oh, my goodness. Oh my!
I said, man, that is all the love I need.
I wonder where those kids are, because that was a lesson for them. That was a lesson,
yes.
Number one, that you came from the north, and I'm sure he gave them all of your history, but you came from a place that you didn't experience it, but you felt the pain, and you knew how this was just not a just thing to happen. And then for you to come back, and then you to be inspiration, you became their instant mentor of, this is how we need to be, and this is to be more articulate. And I'm sure that's when he said, talk like you and speak like you, to be articulate, to be able to express your feelings and your thoughts in a way that everyone can understand.
Well, I know that it made an impact on the kids, I hope, in the way in which you've mentioned as well, because those kids said, you came all the way from Colorado to march with us? And I said, yes, because it's important. The same rights that I have, I want for everyone here to have. And it was wonderful. It was a loving moment. I often wonder whether those kids who would now be middle-aged men and women, whether they ever think back to that. That was, for me, one of the shining moments on the march.
They do. Did you ever think about going back to any of the ceremonies that they're having down there?
You know, I over the years I've considered it, and I've never gone back, but I've often wanted to go back. Because the experiences were so life forming. For instance, I was on the march for 2 days. And 2 nights. The first night, they took a bunch of us over to a black Catholic church called what was it? I forget the name of the church now, but we had no blankets, no anything. We were scared to death because we know that people bomb churches in the South.
Exactly.
They just told us, find yourself a place on the floor and do the best you can. It had the church had a brick floor, and it was, I tell you, that was one of the best beds I've ever slept in. Basically they said, they told us, just try to snuggle up with someone, because if something happens, you want someone there with you to help take care of you, or you help take care of them. So I snuggled up with a young woman who happened to be nearby, and I think we were asleep before our heads hit the floor. But the next morning we got up, they had a little breakfast for us, very simple, and we got back on the march, and just a wonderful thing. That second day on the march just felt like heaven. I mean, it was still, there were vicious people still along the roads, and I could never understand. A couple times I purposely caught the eye of a guardsman. I just wanted to see what could I see in their eyes. Because they're in Alabama. They're in Alabama, but they're having to protect us, and so to speak, protect in quotes. But and you know, they couldn't look you in the eye. I did that many times. At one time, a gentleman who was clearly from the South said, I'm seeing you looking at these guardsmen, and he said, that's not a good idea. That is not a good idea. And I told him, I'm trying to look into their souls and see what's going on inside of them, because these are people the likes of which I've never confronted before.
Exactly.
He said, well, you be careful. They may be Army, but they're Alabamans.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were all those kinds of things happening, along with the praying and the singing. Boy, I'm telling you, some wonderful spiritual
and the rejoicing once. Exactly, the rejoicing once you got over, because were you there the last day? Then you did all 3 days, so you
yes.
were there when okay. And so the rejoicing, the accomplishment. Did
yes.
you stay later on to register people?
No, I didn't. Once we got to Montgomery and then headed back, we were basically assigned to cars, and I saw Miss Luizo, who was she was so helpful. Anything that needed being done, Viola Luizo was there doing it. She was a remarkable person, and so she was driving one of the cars taking people back to Selma. And so I was hanging around trying to get in her car. It turned out that I was assigned to a car, two cars behind hers. And when we got to Selma, the first thing they did, they ran up and said, have you seen Viola Luizo? And we said, yeah, she was two cars ahead of us. And it turns out, of course, that she had been ambushed and killed on the drive back to Selma. And I thought, my goodness, there is a God, because I was trying so desperately to get in her car because I just wanted to talk to her. And she was killed.
Oh,
she was murdered on that highway. She was murdered
did she have
on that highway.
Were
yes,
other people
yes.
in her car? They were all
she
murdered.
Had, no,
were
just
they all
her.
Murdered?
No, oh. She was the only one who was hit. And that road, at a certain point, there was a lot of vegetation and trees and bushes, so that if a car could get in, could go in there out of control or under control and not be seen from the road. And that's exactly what happened. But I must say, though, that I have never, ever forgotten that experience. It was the experience of a life, because for one thing, I confronted racism head on in a way that I had not been able to in my young life up to then. And then secondly, it helped me to know that we have a job to get done. We, all of us, America, has a job to complete. This is just absolute foolishness.
That's what, let me interject that, because that's a question I would like to ask you. Because you fought for the right back in the 60s, and it just seems like we're going backwards in so many ways. What is your feeling on that? Don't you think we need to have a platform where we can become, we need to inform, we need to enlighten, we need to tell people, be aware, wake up, realize what's happening. Because when they're putting in the different obstacles for people to vote, to not be able to vote in the South, it's repeating. It's slowly but surely starting to repeat what we all, what Martin Luther King, what we fought so hard for. What are your feelings on that?
And Casey, to be very honest, I regard the extreme sadness to be that in areas of the North and all over America, people have the right. No one would even think of depriving someone of the right to vote, and yet people won't go vote.
I know.
People achieve the goal that the racists wanted concerning us all along. We contribute to their victory by not getting out and voting, being active, putting demands on those who represent us in our legislatures and in the Congress and Senate. We're helping their cause by not taking up our own cause.
Exactly.
And we need to wake up. The Selma March helped to wake me up, but a person doesn't have to have been down there and seen the awful conditions that people were living under, with rights being taken from them. You don't have to have had that experience to know that if you don't exercise your rights, you lost them. You lost. And our people need to wake up. Our young people, the first thing people should be doing when they turn 18 is joyfully going to register to vote.
Absolutely. And we did. I mean, we used to. It was, you were so proud to be able to do that because we were so fresh, so close to the struggle. You know, we had just accomplished, so we were aware. And the young, the youth, the uninformed children of today, you must vote. You must register. I don't understand. It tears at my heart. It tears at, I think, all of us who are senior citizens or people who are aware. When you listen to the news, you read the newspaper, you just see how it's slowly creeping back in. And if you don't stop it, we will be put so far back in our rights.
Yes, I wish people could have seen, not me, but the group of young people around me, who they were impressed with the way I talked. Well, that's fine. My mom and dad insisted that we talk properly and well, and learn to communicate well. But to see those young people listening and looking at this young guy, who's not a whole lot older than them, who's come down there to help secure their rights. Do we need something like a Selma March to tell us how important it is that we exercise our rights?
Yes.
We have to wake up and get our young people going, get them registered, get them active politically. They don't have to run for office, but if they want to run, they should do that. They should ask questions. They should put demands on the people who represent them, and they should do their homework. That's how I end every speech that I give. Do your homework.
Yes.
When you get home, do your homework.
Yes.
People would be surprised to know how much better things go when you vote and when you do your homework. I guarantee it, everyone who's listening, do your homework, vote, life will get better.
Exactly.
I'm telling you.
If you don't vote, you have no reason and you have no right to complain.
Yes.
You have to be a part of the system to improve the system. So become informed and read. We have a tendency not to want to read. Don't allow someone to tell you what they think. Have an opinion of your own. Do your own research. But you have to get into the game to play.
Exactly.
Become an informed citizen. I tell you, this is such a wonderful, wonderful topic. But quickly, we have only a few minutes left. How did you think the movie Selma depicted that era? Do you think they did a great job? Do you think that movie producer displayed
it did a good job? They had, you know, they had tremendous limits. Just seeing the Pettus Bridge again gave me shivers. But I think they did a very, very good job. I know that that some people felt it should have won an Academy Award. I think the importance of that movie was not the technical aspects of it. What was important and remains and will remain important about that movie is the fact that it demonstrated how brave people were willing to get out and face literally an army to secure their rights. And those rights were so important to them that they would go out and get killed, get beaten, march 54 miles, hitchhike across the country.
Exactly.
What does it take to help people know how important that was and still is? the movie, that was to me the importance of the movie. And the song, everyone should go to bed at night with that song in their mind. That song is a remarkable remembrance of how important music was to us on that march and has been to our people through our history. Music has always been a soothing thing to us.
Exactly. Well, that's how the slaves communicated. That's how the slaves tried to make it through every day. They were in those hot cotton fields. So music has been very instrumental in the African culture. So, yes, but I do believe, I think, yes, let that song get stuck in your head. Learn the words instead of some of the rapping songs that's degrading to women. Learn what it's like to go through and know what you're fighting for. Know what your purpose is. Know the legacy you need to leave. Develop, get a legacy. You know, have a legacy.
Exactly. We should go to bed at night with the words and the tune of glory in our heads. If we didn't already have a black national anthem, that could be it. And
exactly.
And if young people aren't willing to accept the black national anthem, let them accept glory as their anthem. Let them learn it. Let them sing it. Let them harmonize it. And let them know that it came out of a remarkable turn of history, that some brave people who were willing to put their bodies at risk gave to concretize rights for our people.
It is just that important. And it's just like, as your mother would say, when she was being a protective mother of her child, but she was like, don't worry about that. That's not your concern. And as you were so adamant about, it is our concern. It is a part of what's happening to us as a culture, as a race. And so I think that's another thing that needs to be brought back to all of us is the pride. You know, we were black power, and, you know, black is beautiful. Well, it doesn't all have to be a negative approach to it. Those are positive words about being proud of who you are and where you came from. But once again, you have to read, you have to know, you have to be proud of, and you have to reach down. Or you have to reach over and grab somebody's hand and help them. And it's people of color. It's people of color. You don't have to be black to help. People of all colors, we need to really reach out and help each other and not allow the politicians to get in to be in Washington and determine your life.
Yes.
You can't give them that power, that total power. Vote. Vote.
Right, and you know, I wouldn't ask of our young people that they do what I did. What I did was on the fringe of crazy, but I did it anyway because I understood why I felt I needed to have a hand in the establishment of freedom for our people and the right to vote for our people. It was that important to me.
I
ask our young people to just find something that is so important to them that they would really work hard and maybe even encounter danger to see that that right and that thing came to pass for them and for our people.
And that, with that note, I must end the wonderful, wonderful topic and the wonderful show. And Judge Raymond Jones, my dear friend, I really appreciate having you on today. And for my audience, it's time for me to end a wonderful show, and I hope that you enjoyed it. I hope that you learned something. I hope it will inspire you to, number one, pursue your dream, and number two, reach out. Remember, we all need each other. Please tell your family and your friends about the Fly Girl Show. I am your host, Casey Grant, and I am on Wednesdays at 11 o'clock. The call-in number is 347-857-3609. Once again, 347-857-3609. 3609. And with this last few minutes, I'd like to leave you with these words. Remember, your blessings are as numerous as the stars in the sky. Have a pleasant day. Have a pleasant week. And I will see you next Wednesday. This is Casey Grant.